Welcome back to the Bulls Peoples, fans. Doug Tonis here with you to discuss our Chicago Bulls. NBA draft has come and gone. My favorite day of the year. It's my mandate to completely geek out with a bunch of basketball nerds over at my house. Thanks to everyone for making it out to the party. I just love it every year. So much fun. And this was an exciting NBA draft. I mean, like, a lot happened in this draft. And in some ways, it kind of fell out exactly like we thought it would, except completely different. So going back a long time, we were pretty sure the top three picks were going to be Zion Williamson, Ja Morant, and RJ Barrett. I mean, Williamson is in a tier by himself. There's no doubt about that. Memphis basically said, we're going to take Morant. And I think everyone kind of put him as the consensus number two. And then RJ Barrett just seemed like a much better prospect than anyone else. So he was the consensus number three. And so that played out exactly as we thought. No trades, nothing going on there. And now the drama starts. So interestingly, this time, the drama actually started before the draft, which I think is a little bit unusual that it unfolded so early. But we know the number four pick, which was originally to the Lakers and then to the Pelicans, then ends up moving to Atlanta, who gave up quite a bit of value, I think, to move up there. And I think that was a good trade for the Pelicans, in my opinion. Give up a pretty good amount of value to get there. And now they get the fourth pick. And this was originally kind of speculated to be Darius Garland. But Atlanta, right after the trade, announces that they're going to take RJ Hunter. So going into the draft while we're watching it live, we're pretty certain it's going to be RJ Hunter. Turns out to be RJ Hunter. I applaud Atlanta for moving up, even though I think they gave up a pretty good amount of value to do so. Only because if you, in all your analysis, really love someone in this draft, and you've got a whole bunch of picks in this draft, you might as well trade a few of them to move up a little bit and get the guy that you want. Because I don't think there's going to be a lot of hits. So if you're confident that someone is going to be a hit, you know, go ahead and go for it. Take him. In this sense, the only thing is, I think Atlanta gives up a pick from next year. And that, I think, is a little dicey. I would be a little concerned about doing that just because, like I said, I think the draft is going to be stronger next year. And so you gave up something to move up this year. And I just don't know how excited I am about that. But it was viewed as a heavily protected pick. No one knows what the protection is. And so if the protection is good enough and it eventually conveys into a second rounder or whatever else, then it probably doesn't make any difference at all about this. New Orleans also sheds Solomon Hill's salary in this deal. I don't think that was probably that big a factor, but hey, why not? As long as you're going to do this, you might as well go for it. And this ends up turning into a three-team trade, and I was reading somewhere, I'm not sure if this is true, but I think somehow the Lakers got enough in this that they're able to free up cap room and get their max guy now in July 6th, which is what the Lakers were attempting to do. But we'll see how all of it shakes out. So now we go on to number five, and this is the spot where things get interesting for the Bulls because they start discussing how Cleveland is willing to trade this pick for someone who's willing to take on J.R. Smith's contract. And now if you're a Bulls fan, and of course if you're listening to this, we all are, then you know that a lot of Bulls fans really value Darius Garland as the player the Bulls should take. And so Darius Garland is expected to go five at this point. And so at five, you could move up by giving up a little bit of cap room this year in order to take on that contract. And J.R. Smith's contract is not so terrible, really. I mean, it's 1 year, and it's $16 million. You know, like, I just, and it's got a partial guarantee on it. I'm not sure how much guarantee is on it. And so a couple of things occur to me. One, this rumor just doesn't feel right to me. It just didn't seem like that much for the Cavs to do the trade down. Like, there had to be something else involved. But theoretically, if that was on the table and the Bulls could have moved up from from seven by taking on J.R. Smith, I would have probably been pretty okay with doing that and getting Darius Garland. I will say, if the Bulls didn't love Garland for whatever reason, and I think there's plenty of reasons why you could say they shouldn't, so I'm not so upset about that. If they didn't and they liked White more anyway, then staying where they were was definitely the right choice. Anyway, Cleveland doesn't get anything done. Darius Garland goes to the Cavs, which was the pick we now expect at this point. And then we move on to number six. And number six, Bulls fans are hoping that the Timberwolves, who just traded up by working with the Suns, would take Coby White so Jarrett Culver could fall to us. Some Bulls fans in the room very hopeful that Jarrett Culver goes to the Wolves. They end up taking Culver, and White falls to Chicago. I think this trade up by the Suns was very interesting. Sorry, trade back by the Suns, trade up by the Timberwolves, and that they seemed to get very little, and then they took a guy who was viewed as a huge reach. And so here's what I'm going to say about that. One, from a value proposition, the Suns didn't seem to get a lot of value for moving back. They also didn't seem to get a lot of value for that pick they took when they moved back. But if Cam Johnson works out, he's a great player, this was a good move. They got something else by moving back, and maybe he was the guy they were going to take at six. I know it sounds crazy, but they did all their draft analysis. Ignore all these mock drafts, ignore whatever people think. People tend to like start reading what other people think and then end up thinking the same thing. You know, like they'll just be like, they don't have independent thought, right? They just, you see all these mock draft lists that are all kind of similar, and people all cheat off of each other because they don't really want to do all the work themselves. And lo and behold, everyone comes up with pretty similar numbers because no one wants to be that different than anyone else. Even though we know that these things generally aren't remotely accurate later, people don't want to step on that ledge and be that different from the consensus. And so an actual team, though, that's spending thousands of hours doing this could be way different than consensus. And if they're good, they should completely ignore the consensus because there's no reason, you know, to think that that consensus is necessarily accurate either. And so if you look at it from that perspective, then if the Suns said Cam Johnson is our guy, at number six, he's our guy, then at least they got something for moving back. And you can't move a whole lot back farther than 11, because if you loved him that much, you have to assume there's a pretty good chance someone else loves him as much as we do. You know, and even though he's mocked in the 20s or 20, you know, someone else is going to love him as much as we do. And what we saw in this draft, the mock drafts that were out there were just all over the board. Like it was not an accurate depiction of what happened. And so if the Suns didn't take him, I could believe that someone else might have. And so I think that's okay. I think it's okay what they did if they love the guy. I don't know enough about the prospect to know if it's going to work out. I don't know if he's going to be a good player. But if he was their guy, then I think they kind of did what they could. They took as much risk as they could. They moved back about as far as they could without feeling like it was a huge risk to get their guy. Now, if they just didn't know what they were doing and they were hoping someone else was going to slide to 11 and that guy got taken and then they just panicked and took Cam Johnson, then this was a train wreck. So don't know enough about the Suns to know. And now we get to our beloved Bulls. Chicago Bulls taking Coby White at number seven to Chance of Coby. The Bulls finally got Coby and all kinds of other fun things. Coby White might be the greatest name ever for a basketball player if you are a fan of puns, because you've first got all these Coby Bryant puns. I love calling him the White Coby because it just seems like such a crazy mockery of all kinds of things. Like you're comparing him to Coby, but the White Coby just sounds like it's going to be a lesser version of Coby, which then has its own weird NBA, you know, stereotypical things, kind of like the White Mamba, but that's already taken. But then because it's also just a play on his name, it's just a funny way of doing it. Then anytime he gets a board, someone at the draft party came up with, it's a whiteboard, which I think is also great. So, you know, maybe the Bulls will start a Coby steak giveaway whenever Coby scores 30 points. I mean, there's just the possibilities are endless here. It's going to be amazing. I love this name, if nothing else. And so now breaking down Coby White, I think there's all kinds of stuff you can talk about. And here's my scouting report. I would say I'm going to keep it brief, but I'm probably not. So if you don't want to hear a whole lot about Coby White, then you're probably not listening to this anyway. So Coby, shooting form, we're going to start with this. He's a one-motion shooter, and if you're not aware of what a one-motion shooter is, a one-motion shooter is a guy who, when they bring the ball up, they push forward without ever cocking the ball back. So the ball ever only goes through one motion. It never changes direction. When they touch the ball and they go for their shot, it's just a straightforward and upward motion. A two-motion shooter is a guy who kind of takes the ball, and as they're bringing it up, they pull it back maybe behind their head, and then they push it forward afterwards. So a one-motion shooter is someone who's going to have a quicker release speed usually by quite a bit. They're typically going to have a lower release point because you're not pulling the ball actually back above your head. I guess technically maybe it's not always true, but you see a lot of one motion shooters with lower release points. And so you have a lot of successful guys who are both in the league. Michael Jordan, as an example, is a two motion shooter. Stephen Curry, as an example, is a one motion shooter. Probably not exclusively true, but it seems like guys who are more physical and have more physical strengths and upside and size advantages tend to be two motion shooters because they're less likely to be blocked. They can drive to a position, they can absorb some contact, they can pull the ball back behind their head and then release it. Guys who are using their speed to get to their spot and find an opening are often more one motion shooters. They're trying to just get a little breathing room and then just fire up the shot as quickly as they can. You know, a guy who's a one motion shooter is going to be looking to get to his spot, shoot off the dribble real quick while the guy is not expecting it and can't get a hand up and he's caught in between decisions. A guy who's a two motion shooter is going to try and create some physical separation, and now he's almost going to pause in midair and he's going to release that shot. So you can be successful with either look. It's not to say one is better than the other, but just so you kind of are aware of what's going on here. Now, Coby White, he's got a low release point relative to one, to people in general. That's pretty common with one motion shooters, but he's probably a little lower than a lot of guys are. And this allows him to get his shot off very quickly, but it does allow him to be bothered by length and for people to block his shot because he also doesn't have great height. I guess technically his great height is short arms, but he doesn't have great length, we'll say. And so he can be bothered then by other people trying to block his shot. So he needs to get a decent amount of space off. People with long arms and length are going to be able to get that ball that has a low release point, especially because he's not going to bring that behind his head, which also creates a little bit more room. He does have a nice form. He uses his guide hand well. He's consistent with his release, consistent with his form. He can shoot off the dribble. He can shoot off the step back. He can shoot when open. So he is a shooter, and he is a shooter who has all of the advanced shooting styles. People will often look at a guy and say, oh, this guy's a great shooter, or they'll look at three-point percentage. And the problem with that is you're comparing some guy who's taking, you know, off the dribble step back threes to a guy who's only taking open kickouts from the corner, and that 3-point percentage might be similar, but the ability of those guys to shoot is radically, radically different. So Coby White is a guy who can shoot in all of the advanced shooting ways you could think of a guy might shoot. He shoots well off the dribble, he shoots well off the step back, he shoots well when kicked out to. His form is pretty consistent no matter which type of shot he's taking. He just can create space with his one of those one step in, dribble, jump back, step back moves that usually gives you 5 or 6 feet of space. You know, he's got that move down. It's just overall pretty good footwork on his shooting and ability to create that little space while shooting. So another thing with Coby, he's not a guy who's, I'd say, a plus athlete. I'd say he's, you know, an average NBA caliber athlete is maybe the best way to put it, which is, you know, way the heck more athletic than I'll ever be in my life or in my wildest dreams. But in the NBA level, he's probably an average caliber athlete. He's not someone who seems to me like he's likely going to be able to create a whole lot off the dribble, at least certainly not with his athleticism. He's not going to be at a huge athletic disadvantage either, though. He's probably going to need a lot of picks, pick and roll moves to get his shots into play. He's not someone who's going to create in isolation or get you a lot of looks in that manner. He does seem like someone who plays with a lot of speed pretty much all of the time. He is always in go mode, and you see that on both ends of the court. You see that on defense, you see that on offense, and so he puts pressure, applies a lot of pressure to the opposing defense by always charging hard at them, sometimes to his detriment because he doesn't always finish at a very high level. He doesn't always make good decisions, but he is always putting a lot of pressure on the opposing defense, and he will be fun to watch. In this sense, I think one of the big things he's going to have to learn in the NBA and will learn over his rookie year, and I actually expect Coby to probably have a pretty poor rookie year, so I don't have a whole lot of expectations right now, but I think he's someone who hopefully will learn from that rookie year and then has a lot of potential to be very good in his second year. He is someone who has a lot of refinement to do. He plays at one speed. He's not mixing up his speeds. He doesn't have a lot of court vision. He's not a good passer. He's someone who can get very much just set on what he's doing. He's a scoring guard that is converting into a point guard, at college, and you see flashes of that, and you see the improvements of that, but you still see he has a way to go in that area. Definitely stares down his passes. He throws a lot of balls that get picked off because he telegraphs his passes. Doesn't make really complicated passes at all. Is someone who only makes obvious passes. Definitely does not strike me as like a natural point guard yet at this level, so that'll be another area he has to learn. He's got to mix up his pace a little bit better. Will need picks. I think in the modern NBA, this type of guy is more valuable than he was in the past, because we moved away from this one lead point guard type guy who brings up the floor and handles most of the action. And now you're moving to this multiple ball handler, multiple threat type of system. And I think Coby White fits better in that type of system. Maybe he's like a Lou Williams type of player if things work out well. I would say he is probably not a guy who has star potential, but you never know. Physically, he is a below-the-rim player. He is someone with limited length. At first, I'm like, oh, a 6'5 point guard, this is going to be great. But he's got like the length of a 6'1 or 6'2 point guard. So he doesn't play tall. He doesn't really have any advantage that's coming from that height. He is bothered by length. He can't finish over length real well. Defensively, he definitely gets on it. High effort player. Plays defense like he plays offense at one speed, which is fast. But he doesn't have the length to really disrupt the passing lanes. Doesn't have the length to block guys. When he makes a mistake, he can't use his length to recover. And so I think that is an issue that will be something that he's just going to have to work through. But he puts forth a lot of effort. I think his fundamentals are pretty good. He helped and overhelped a lot at UNC. Some of those things, you don't know what the scheme is versus what the player is just doing on their own. And you got to see how he's going to be coached out of it. And I think this is maybe the piece that's most interesting to me about White, is so many of the things he's doing right now are areas where he needs improvement and he needs coaching. You know, he's trying to develop more from a shooting guard or scoring guard to more of a point guard type player in the NBA. At least that's what we expect. Defensively, he has a lot of habits that are going to need to be changed when he's guarding NBA caliber players. And so this is a guy who I wouldn't say is raw by any stretch, especially given the type of shooter that he is and the type of advanced shots that he can make. But he is a guy who will need to change the way he plays to adapt to the NBA once he's playing against a different caliber of athlete and competition. And so his current game is not going to be the game that gets him there in the NBA. But I do think he is someone who has very solid, strong potential and has a lot of things that can do well. I just think he's a guy, certainly I'd be very surprised if he ever became a star player, but I do think he will be someone who is one of your really great off-the-bench sub-in players. Like, and people hear off the bench and they start thinking like sixth or seventh best player in the team. Usually your best bench player is like your fourth best guy in your team. And I'd say Coby White strikes me as a guy whose potential is to be that. And that may sound awful and not what you want to get, but in this draft, if Coby White becomes a solid player, I think I'll be pretty happy with it. From an NBA comparison on the Bulls, I kind of think there's parts of him that remind me a lot of Kirk Heinrich. Not Kirk Heinrich in college. I didn't actually watch Kirk Heinrich in college, so I have no idea what Kirk Heinrich looked like in college. But Kirk Heinrich, as a good NBA player, like when he was playing well, Coby White strikes me, if things work out, to be somewhat player similar in the sense that Kirk Heinrich was an aggressive kind of over dribbler, not an amazing ball handler, but he was a conservative ball handler, didn't make a whole lot of mistakes, not a great passer, but didn't make a whole lot of mistakes. He was a very good shooter, but limited athleticism, wasn't a creator, was a below the rim finisher, was a good fundamentally strong defender, but not someone who was had a huge athletic advantage and kind of, you know, did what he could. There's a lot of traits in that comparison that like feel right to me. I don't think Kirk Heinrich ever played with this all-out aggression of intensity and just one complete speed all the time, and was definitely not the same type of player in transition. So it's not a perfect comparison, but there's pieces of that to me, and I think like that makes sense. And every guy is always a unique guy. Like, comparisons always fail. But if I were to say, where do I think Coby ends up if things work out well? I think his overall talent level and impact on the team would be similar to having Kirk Heinrich, a guy who is a solid guy. I mean, if you think of Kirk Heinrich, would he be the best guy on your team, second or third best guy on a team that was like great? Like, probably not. He's probably like now maybe the fourth best guy in a team that's really good. And I think that's kind of what you get with Coby White when you draft him, if things go well. If things go badly, of course, Coby White can just be Chris Dunn or any number of guys who is just completely worthless. And I got to be honest with you, I would not be surprised if that happens, and not just for White. Just looking up and down the prospects in this draft, I just think they are just a complete crapshoot, like fairly poor set of prospects. And in that sense, you could argue the best thing to do is to try to trade down. But as we saw with the Suns trading down to 11, there was not much value to be had for trading down. And you definitely could have traded into this draft if you wanted to, but boy, I would not really be excited to have tried to pick up any extra picks in this draft, given how weak I thought the draft was. And so that was my long spiel on Coby White. Hopefully you're still listening and didn't get bored listening to that. And so we go through all kinds of stuff in the draft, and because I was really focused on only the picks 1 through 7 and maybe like 2 or 3 other guys, I have no idea the value of anyone else after that. I could not even tell you who I think was good or bad. You know, sorry, you'll get some great draft analysis on ESPN or some other site. But I will then start talking about Gafford, whom the Bulls draft at 38, Daniel Gafford. And, you know, we're all sitting there in a draft party. We get to like 23 and Bol Bol is still on the board. And of course, just like anything, we're like, no one in the room really knows a whole lot about the draft at this point. There's a couple guys who are really smart guys, you know, everything. But most of us were just kind of like focused only on the Bulls' number 7 pick and not looking that much. But we started thinking like, hey, Bol Bol is dropping. Maybe he'll be there at 38 and the Bulls can take him. And as it gets closer and closer, we start chanting Bol Bol after every pick. We start making puns about Bol Bol, Bol Bol. You know, whatever. We're having a good time with it. And I just joking, I said, well, one of two things is going to happen. Either Bol is going to go at 37, and we're all going to like be really upset, or he's going to be at 38 and we're going to take someone else. And that's exactly, of course, what happens. And Bol falls a few more picks after us. I think he went 44 overall. I don't really have any real opinion. I mean, I looked at Bol Bol scouting and I'm like, I don't know if this guy's going to be any good. Theoretically, he's an athletic guy who can shoot jumpers, but his release is like so slow. I just don't know how much that was really going to translate to the NBA anyway. And he certainly didn't seem like a physical guy who was going to do a whole lot. And he's hurt. And my guess is that injury was probably pretty bad given how many teams passed on him. Or it was just one of those things where like all of the guys who are scouting the NBA, but not related to NBA scouts, but just, you know, watching college basketball and making up their own things, just kind of put Bol in this rating based on what they thought. And then they all kind of cheated and copied off each other and said he was high. But literally every team in the NBA said, nah, this guy is not an NBA player. And then he fell down to the 40s. But I think probably more likely the case is that the injury, teams got medical on him and said, yeah, this is just not going to be great. Rumors that he didn't love the game and his attitude was not so great. Maybe didn't help him either. You know, who knows? I'm not certain. But either way, the Bulls passed on Bol. You can be really upset about that if you want to. I don't really care because typically, not always true, but typically when the whole league passes on a guy who's expected to be really high, there's usually a pretty good reason. And I think most of the time the league is correct. Now there's some exceptions. I think DeAndre Jordan is a great exception of a guy who is viewed as a high prospect who fell to the second round and the league was wrong. And JaVale McGee is another guy who was viewed as a very high prospect who fell very far. So maybe especially with 7-footers, you shouldn't let that happen. I don't know. But sometimes guys are rated very highly just because they're 7 feet tall. So enough about Bol and why the Bulls didn't draft him. Personally, I'm okay with it, though. I would have been excited if we got him too. The Bulls do end up with Daniel Gafford. And so we're all sitting there and we're depressed. Like, we didn't get Bol. We wanted Bol. And no one, I mean, I don't know. I didn't know who Daniel Gafford was like 5 seconds earlier. So then they just like start throwing the Daniel Gafford highlight reel out there. And he does this absolutely ridiculous, like windmill dunk. And everyone in the room is just like, oh, never mind. We want this guy. And it was pretty hilarious. I mean, man, Gafford just looks like, I'm just watching him. Like, how is this guy available at 38, especially in this draft class that sucks? This guy looks like a beast. I mean, he's 6'10", he's got a 9'2 standing reach, and he's ridiculously athletic. And yes, he can't shoot a lick, but I'm thinking, this just feels like Clint Capella to me. Like, and maybe Clint Capella would suck if he was on any other team outside of the Rockets. But this guy just looks like just a ridiculous guy to stick in the dunker spot and just hit close shots around the rim. He can block shots. He can do a decent amount of things. So we'll see what happens with Gafford. I didn't dig as deep in him. I'm sure he fell to 38 for a reason. I'm sure the athleticism was good and other things were good. There's got to be a bunch of skill problems, the fact that he was still sitting there. But I was excited to see him throw down some really crazy dunks, which is a terrible, terrible way to evaluate anyone. It's awful. So he probably won't be anything. He'll probably be completely worthless. Given that I thought the guys at the top of this draft are likely to be worthless, the odds that Gafford's going to be amazing at 38 are pretty low. But if we get to see some ridiculous dunks and don't get to see Felicio, I will not be upset about that. So we'll see how things go with him. But just in my 30 seconds of saying a guy is 6'11 and ridiculously athletic and available at 38, why not? Just why not? That just seems like a combination that I could get behind if I am going to just take a flyer on someone. I could say, yeah, there might be some value in that. Will he ever learn to shoot? Who knows? He's a terrible shooter now. I think it's like a 50% free throw shooter, which doesn't project out well. So he needs to learn to shoot. But just stick this guy with a shooting coach for like 5 hours a day, every day in the summer, and see if you can fix that. And if you can, then man, you really might have something there. But maybe not. Probably not. Probably not. Never expect anything out of a second round pick, especially in a draft this lousy. Because when you think about it, like normally there's, I mean, it'd be like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 guys that are better than the guys who are in like the top 15. You know, like maybe the, obviously Williamson is an elite number one pick. And maybe Morant is a quality number two pick and Barrett's three. But after that, you'd expect there to be a bunch of better prospects than you had. So everyone that was drafted in a different draft would be drafted like 6 spots later, effectively. And so when you think about that, like whoever's available at 38, in a normal draft, that's probably like 44, 45. And so you're starting, those picks are typically complete trash. So I'm gonna douse cold water on anyone who thinks Gafford's gonna be amazing. But hey, I saw a few highlights and I was at least excited for 30 seconds. So then the rational part of me said, yeah, this probably isn't gonna be so great as I think it is. And so that'll sum up my Bulls draft content. So hopefully that wasn't too worthless and painful for you. I'm just having fun doing the show again. And I'm now gonna go off. Instead of discussing the Bulls draft, I'm going to talk a little bit now about the NBA overall. And I just think this is a crazy fun time to be an NBA fan. I mean, if you look at the teams that were kind of at the top of the mountain last year, and you look at the ones you would have expected, we're going back in time. It's 2008 in September, and we are thinking about who should be available, or who should be good in the NBA? Who should be good in the NBA? And in the West, you're thinking it's the Golden State Warriors. Everyone thinks the Warriors are going to walk away with this unless they have a bunch of injuries. Now, granted, that probably was an accurate assessment, but the Warriors did have a bunch of injuries, and they obviously lost to the Toronto Raptors. But you'd say the second best team, the team that has any chance or hope to take out the Warriors, the only one who has hope is the Houston Rockets in the West. And then the rest of the West, you'd be like, yeah, there's some other guys. They're good teams. But those are the teams. Those are the teams that have a chance. Now, on the East, you would say, well, there's the Raptors, maybe if Kawhi stays healthy. But, God, who knows what's going on there. Then you're like the 76ers, maybe. I mean, they had a great run. The Celtics could possibly put things together and be really exciting. I think that's going to go really great. And man, Giannis is coming on. I think the Bucks could be good. And then after that, you're like, wow, this is crap. So now I just named 6 teams. Of those 6 teams, 5 of them are facing major questions about whether they'll even be a competitive team next year. I mean, the Warriors are going to be down Thompson and Durant. And we just saw Curry and a bunch of crap may not get you very far. Houston now, Chris Paul is demanding a trade, but has like the worst or second worst contract in the NBA. So who knows what Houston's going to do there, but they have a chemistry nightmare now. And they feel like that whole thing is going to implode. Boston is going to lose Kyrie Irving almost for certain, like 99% chance. And Al Horford opted out, which was mind blowing. No one thought that was going to happen. And there's a rumor he might get over $100 million, which is crazy, but who knows. And so they're going to lose him as well. And their young guys, after thinking, oh, these guys are going to step up, we're awful. So Boston looks like it just is going to fall into the crapper. Philadelphia has to now sit and debate. We have 4 great players that don't fit together at all, and we have to decide whether to max two of them. And one of them is Tobias Harris, who really is not that good to max, and we're going to be deep into the tax if we do so. So they're facing all kinds of questions. So, I mean, that's like five of the best six teams last year are facing huge questions this offseason. And I think that just opens up the NBA to like anything is possible. Anything is possible this year. And it's been a long time since you could feel that way as an NBA fan, that anything is possible. And I think that is great. It's going to be an exciting free agency just to see what happens. I don't think the Bulls are going to do anything too exciting. I know that'll disappoint a lot of people. They don't have max cap room. They could maybe quasi get it if they stretch Dunn and they stretch Felicio. The problem with that is it only gets you to the low-level max, the restricted free agent max, not the unrestricted free agent max. And then the problem with that is stretching those guys and creating that room will have a negative impact on the franchise for a few years. And then if you do that and you make an offer to a restricted free agent and it's matched, you've now done that, you've gotten no one, and you're in a worse position. So it's kind of a weird risk to have to try to figure out and take if you are the Chicago Bulls, because you have to make those moves just to make the offer, and then you may not get the player anyway. And I don't know if that'll happen, but we'll see where things go. I think the one chance you might see the Bulls do something like that for is if they like D'Angelo Russell and the Nets get Kyrie Irving, then you know they're not going to match on Russell, and now you can feel confident that if you make these moves and Russell agrees that you'll actually get him. And that's the one scenario I could kind of see working out. I could see them making a offer to Malcolm Brogdon of this is the most we can offer, and I would completely be on board doing that, which probably ends up being around $90 million over 4 years. And I know some people will say Malcolm Brogdon isn't worth it, blah, 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 blah. Otto Porter isn't worth it. Otto Porter is not worth the contract he has. It's okay, though. Like, these contracts are so short now that you just don't get hung up on them. This isn't the old days where you're signing Jamal Crawford for 7 years, and now this dude is killing your cap, and if he sucks after 3 years, you're screwed. I mean, Malcolm Brogdon is not going to fall off the map next year. He'll probably still be a fine player, and he's young enough, he should be fine this whole contract. But let's just say Malcolm Brogdon has an off year. It's not as good as you expected. Well, you know, in another year, you'd still be like, yeah, well, okay, he had an off year, but he can come back, he can still be good. So now 2 years have gone by, and you say, well, boy, this guy just isn't that great. It's not that great, not working out. Well, okay, now you're stuck at most with 2 years of bad salary. Oh, well, I mean, the thing you're giving up is you're giving up the opportunity to have maximum cap room in 2 seasons from now. And going and looking at that season, the free agents are Giannis, amazing, would love him, unrestricted free agent. Damian Lillard, sounds amazing, but Lillard is going to start at 30% of the cap, maybe 35%, I think it's 30%, maybe 35%, I forget how many years he has. But the guy is 31 years old, and you're now going to have to pay him something like $180 million for 4 years. And you know what? At 31 years old, we're going to get years 31, 32, 33, and 34. And Lillard is a guard that is going to rely a lot on athleticism and will be clearly in decline. I would say that is a risk that maybe works out and maybe doesn't, but it's not like an amazingly better risk than taking Brogdon at whatever the max is. CJ McCollum, similar to Lillard, but nowhere near as good, and he'll only be 30, so he won't be quite as much on the downside, but also will probably command that 30-plus million, like near $180 million contract at that point in time. Not a guy that I think I want to pay that much money to. And then Rudy Gobert will be the other big-name free agent, unrestricted, 29. Same thing, probably requires a $30-plus million contract. Don't think he will give you that much impact. And so Giannis, now there's one guy I'm chasing, but there'll probably be a whole ton of teams with cap space, so we'd be the best situation. Would Giannis really come here? Who knows? It could go either way, but now you'd be setting all of your hopes on getting one guy 2 years from now. There's really no reason to think you're any special destination for him versus any of the other places he could go. And so to me, that's a fairly low chance that if you go in that direction, anything's going to work out for you. So to me, take the best player you can now. Just take the best player, whoever he is. Just take the best player and try and get him onto your team. And let's try and get this team that's won 20 games for a few years into the 40-win, area and actually enjoy a basketball season, which has been a few years since we've been able to do. I would say let's go for that. You got a lot of young guys. Hope that Lowry, Levine, White, even though I just said he's not going to, or Wendell become better players than you think they will be, and that you get a really good player, be it Russell or Brogdon or someone else, and that that group can go make something happen. I think that is the plan I would take, even if you end up overpaying. You've already overpaid Otto Porter. I mean, I guess we didn't technically overpay him, but we have him on an overpaid contract by quite a bit. You've underpaid Zach LaVine relative to what I think he would get as a free agent right now. I think if you could pay Zach LaVine anything you wanted, if there were no restrictions, I think he would get a $30 million a year contract right now. That may sound crazy, but I think it would definitely happen, especially this season with Clay and with Durant out, that there's a lot of money that you expected to be moving around potentially that's no longer moving around. So we'll see. That's what I think the Bulls should do with their cap space. It does not look like we're going to get the exception for Omer Asik due to medical reasons. I say that with no information other than that I've not seen a single person talk about the result anywhere, and I just figure if that happened, it would have had to have been news and someone would know, and that we are now, you know, 8 days away from free agency kicking off, and so it just seems like something that should have happened by now if it was going to. So no insight there. I've not read anything that says we're not going to get it. It just really feels like if it was going to happen, it would have already happened, and it hasn't. Or it has happened and just no one knows about it, which also seems unlikely to me, but I suppose you never know. So a few more things we're going to chat about, and I'm going to wrap it up and get you out of here. First, crazy trade idea that you are all going to hate. Everyone listening to this is going to hate this. Please listen to the show after I say this idea again. It just came to me, but Houston is a problem. Houston, there is a problem, and that is that Chris Paul and James Harden hate each other. And James Harden is really great, and Chris Paul is really not so great anymore, and is paid like a really, really great player. And so we could help alleviate this problem in such a way that Houston might be excited about by offering up Felicio, Chris Dunn for Chris Paul and taking back a buttload of draft picks. And I just wonder if that is a move that's worth making. So Chris Paul has 3 years left on his deal. Dunn and Felicio are crap, but they're paid about a total of $20 million. So Chris Paul is owed, I think it's like $140 million roughly over 3 years. Sorry, $120 million roughly over 3 years. $120 million. So knock $20 million off that, because Dunn and Felicio suck. So if we dump them $20 million, we're now paying Chris Paul effectively $100 million in like real opportunity costs on our payroll, because $20 million of it was dead anyway that we shipped off. So how many draft picks does it take to be worth $100 million? But that's not entirely fair, because Chris Paul is not a guy who's worth zero on the court. You wouldn't pay him $35 million or $40 million, whatever he would make. Now, if we're saying, for us, a financial impact is really $100 million in terms of financial impact to us, even though he's making a little more. So you wouldn't pay him $33 million. But you might pay him, say, $60 million over 3 years, right? Like Chris Paul might have $60 million of value. He's still a really good player. He could still help out this team a lot, especially if you want to get better next year. I think Chris Paul would do more than Brogdon or D'Angelo Russell to help make this team a good team. So I could easily see, since I just said I would pay Brogdon or Russell like the max, which is like $27 million, and say, I don't worry about it. And those contracts would last for 4 years, where Chris Paul only lasts for three. So I have to then, by the same logic, say Chris Paul now to me is worth $25 million a year for 3 years. All right, that's probably a little bit dicey logic, but let's roll with it for a little bit longer. And now I've subtracted $20 million of dead money, and he's worth $75 in this example. And that gets me up to $95. And now I have another $25 million that's left. And if Houston's willing to give me 3 or 4 first-round draft picks in the future, is that worth the remaining $25 million? And I think maybe it is. I think that maybe makes sense for the Chicago Bulls. And so I know that sounds weird, I may be getting into, in my head, like too deep in terms of how I'm mathematically analyzing this situation. But I think that's not a crazy idea. Now, the question would be, would Chris Paul come here and then just be an asshat, or would he be an asset? So sorry, I laughed at my own joke. That's awful. I don't know. I mean, Chris Paul, was one of those guys who now seems like the aging vet who's not realized he's no longer nearly as good as he used to be and just thinks like, well, if they just gave me the ball more, things would work out better. So there'd be some concerns as well that really, is he actually worth that $25 million that I pegged him to be worth? And the question, the answer to that very well may be no, not really. And then all of a sudden now, if it's like, well, he's really only worth $50 million over 3 years, now you need to make up $55 million in draft picks. And all of a sudden, that probably seems a lot dicier. But I think it's an interesting idea. I think it's an interesting idea. I would not hate it if it happened. I'd not hate it if it happened. I think it would actually make the Bulls season probably quite a bit more exciting. But it would be reliant on Chris Paul actually not being a jerk. I'm not sure I could rely on that or not. And so final topic of the day is the Lakers trade with the Pelicans for Anthony Davis. Got to talk about it. And everyone seemed to be like, oh man, the Lakers got Davis. Why do the Lakers get everything they want? This is lousy. And I look at it and I think, man, the Pelicans pulled off the best superstar trade I can think of happening in I don't know how long. I mean, hats off to David Griffin for doing this, I gotta say. Because the Lakers bid against themselves. Who else was coming close to this offer? Like, no one. No one was even touching this offer outside of the Lakers. I just think that was a tremendous thing. Now, in my opinion, I think the Pelicans screwed up by trading the number four and trading down. But if they didn't like the options at four, it makes sense. But so if you think of what the Knicks weren't going to say, oh, we'll give you number three and three more like unprotected first round picks in the future. Like, that was not going to happen. And a bunch of prospects now. Like, I mean, and I don't think super highly of the prospects they're getting now, but, you know, decent prospects at least. I mean, Ingram seems like there's hope that he could be a pretty darn good player. I mean, he's got some things going for him and could be pretty good. Granted, he's a free agent in a year, so even if he is good, you're paying market value to him, which is not a special situation, so it's not as exciting. Lonzo Ball is a guy who's been injured, and, you know, parts of him look really special, and if you're a Bulls fan, you've probably talked Lonzo Ball to death because of the rumors of him getting traded to us. I personally kind of feel like, thank goodness that didn't happen. Not because I'm so certain that Coby White will be better than Lonzo Ball. I'm not. Just that Lonzo Ball only has 2 years left. He's been hurt both his years. And there's not really a lot of reason to think he'll be great either. Like, he's another guy who's got a lot of question marks that he has to answer. And there's a lot of negative things about him. But he definitely has great upside. I think if Lonzo Ball worked out, he'd be better than Coby White if Coby White works out. It's just, after 2 years, you have a lot of reasons to think Lonzo Ball won't work out. But as a prospect, it's still like, yeah, someone I would like as a throw-in. If I could get him for free, I'd love to have Lonzo Ball and see how things go, because I think there's some upside there. And Hart is also another good player who's a solid guy who's going to fit in your team and do a bunch of stuff. So you got those guys. And then you get the 2021 pick, top eight protected. Now, probably, I just did kind of a weird shoulder shrug thing in my head there. Probably that pick will be conveyed and will not land in the top eight. You never know. But our expectation is that in 2021, which would be 2 years from now in the draft, 2 seasons from now, that the Lakers will still be pretty good. That Anthony Davis and LeBron James will find enough pieces around them to be a playoff team. And if they are not a playoff team, will probably be enough to be someone who barely missed the playoffs. You never know, especially because you're likely one injury away from being in the tank again. So you probably get a pick, we'll say, somewhere in the, I don't know, I'm going to guess that you're going to get a pick in the low 20s, like say 21, 22, somewhere in that range. I don't think the Lakers are actually going to be as good as everyone else seems to think they will be when they say that, oh boy, the Pelicans just gave the Lakers a dynasty. I don't think it's going to work out that well for them, but we'll find out. We'll find out. So probably I think you're going to get a pick in the 20s, low 20s, in 2021. The interesting thing is now you're going to get the right to swap picks in 2023. And you go to 2023 and LeBron James is 38. At the time LeBron James is 38, we can project it is likely that he will have played more NBA minutes than any player in the entire history of the NBA. Ever. Who will have played more minutes at 38 than Kareem played in his career, who is currently the number one? He will certainly have played more minutes than Karl Malone, who's number two, unless he is hurt. But if he is hurt for a couple years, that also doesn't project out well for what he'll do at 38. And he should pass Dirk, who's number three this year. This is combined regular season and playoff minutes, just so you know, which I think is more important. It's actually worse for LeBron that he has so many playoff minutes in terms of like how much of a toll it takes on your body physically, because you're getting more minutes of compressed time, which less heel time, and you get me. So going into the season that will decide where this pick is conveyed, LeBron, I think, will likely have considerable slowdown. Considerable slowdown. Anthony Davis will be 32, and we'll see what other pieces they're able to get. Kyle Kuzma, you know, should have plenty of time to improve, might become a very good player, is off to a nice start in his career. We'll see what happens with him. And the Lakers have some rooms. They're going to add some guys this year, and those guys will age to wherever they are. There's a rumor that they're going to get Kemba Walker. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, they get Kemba Walker. He would be, I think, 35. I would expect very little out of him that year either. So the Lakers will not have a whole lot of ability to improve their roster over this time. They're going to have mid-level exceptions. And that's it. They'll have their 2020 pick. They'll lose the 2021 pick. They'll have the 2022 pick. Those probably won't be picks that project out well. Lakers won't have a lot of ways to improve, and they'll have a very aging roster. LeBron might retire. He might leave. He might do whatever. Anthony Davis may leave the year after that, or may leave actually after this year if he doesn't sign an extension. You know, who knows what's going to happen with him either. So it's like this plan is fraught with all kinds of risks. The Lakers got Dwight Howard, and he left after a season. Let's not forget. So they then have the 2024 pick unprotected going to the Pelicans. But what's interesting about this is the Pelicans then have the option to say no thank you to that pick. We'll take it unprotected in 2025. And so if they can see the writing on the wall, like, we got the 15th pick in 2024, but man, this team's going to fall apart next year, they can defer the pick and take it next year. And so the Pelicans really have an outstanding chance to get some pretty great draft picks. I think this is a trade that, if the Pelicans run this correctly and things work out well, could be a deal that ends up making the Pelicans just set for a super long time. So we'll see what happens with that trade. We'll see what happens. But I think this is a trade. It may work out great for the Lakers. Lakers might win a title. But the Pelicans also could have won this trade. And for a superstar where you're always, your back is against the wall, I do not think the Pelicans could have done any better. I think they are off to a great start in the Zion Williamson era. So I think that'll do it for this edition of the Bulls Beat. Thank you for listening. We'll try to do it more frequently in the future.